This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, with episode 910-910. Thank you so much for joining me today as we talk with Mark Sanborn. He is the author of a very, very, very famous book that you've all heard of, probably many of you have read. That is entitled The Fred Factor, The Fred Factor. And you know, that book is a great story about just being the best at whatever we do. Just being the best person we can be. You know, there's an old saying in Hollywood, and I was just talking about this a couple weeks ago with one of our clients and who is in the Hollywood industry, in the Hollywood business, actor and movie maker and so forth. And the saying is, you probably know what I'm going to say, don't you? The saying is, there are no small parts, only small actors. There are no small parts, only small actors. And you know, when we go the extra mile, when we do the best we can, when we're the best at our chosen career or profession, when we're the best landlord, the best real estate investor, the world pays us back with tenfold returns. We'll be talking a little bit about that today with Mark Sanborn. Of course, he was president of the National Speakers Association. He is also the author of his newest book, The Potential Principle. The Potential Principle, of course, the Fred Factor that we talked about. But before we get to that, I want to share just a little bit of a thought I had on the crazy, seemingly tulip bubble type situation that is going on in the world of cryptocurrencies and namely Bitcoin nowadays. Well, you know, some of you may not understand how this stuff works. I didn't for a long time. It took me quite a while to understand it. And it's just sort of a crazy thing. So think about this for a moment. The reason something has value is because of its scarcity and, well, also utility, of course. But assuming it's useful and has utility, then scarcity is another huge value driver. And debatable which is the biggest value driver, because gold, for example, that has been a measuring stick of value for many, many years, for millennia, actually, doesn't have a lot of utility, really. Silver actually has much more utility as an industrial metal than gold, right? But let's talk about this as it applies to Bitcoin. So if we compare it with gold and silver, as an example, or any precious metal or diamonds, for example, which have a very high value, they have to be mined. These things have to be mined out of the earth. You've heard me say that all value comes from the earth. All wealth comes from the earth. And, you know, ultimately that's true, especially in the old world. Now, you could argue that some of it today comes from thinking, from technology. And if you look at a country like Japan with virtually no natural resources, but very smart people who have extracted the value from their mind, right? But you could certainly argue that humans ultimately come from the earth, right? So, you know, we won't go there. That's a sort of a very big tangent. But you have to mine precious metals. You have to mine diamonds. And it's expensive to mine these things. And they are scarce. They are hard to find. So that is a big driver of their value. Well, with cryptocurrencies, and I'll use Bitcoin as the example, you have to mine it. And mining it is essentially a mathematical calculation that a computer server does to mine the limited number of coins. And these computers use a lot of energy to mine the coins. And the more coins that have been mined, the harder the equation is to mine them. Yes, it's a weird new world, folks. I'll be the first to agree. I mean, this is crazy stuff. So there was an economist, and forgive me, I cannot remember who talked about the concept of, I think he called it fake work. And, you know, we hear a lot today about fake news. And, you know, with all the stuff that's written on the internet, with all the stuff in the mainstream news media, with the last presidential election, we certainly know that the truth is hard to come by. Yes, the truth is hard to come by in today's world. As George Orwell talked about in 1984, he talked about, what do you call it, the streamlined person, right? The person who speaks in like glib slogans and there's no real depth to their thought, right? Are very gullible and they have other people who are very gullible that follow them that don't bother to think deeply about things. And look, this is a trait of our nature. Our mind, well, our brain, really, we'll talk about the physical thing, that the mind is more of a abstraction, right? But the brain, the thing in our skull, the actual physical thing, right? It is a miser. It takes a lot of energy to power that thing. It's the biggest energy consumer in our bodies is our brain, right? And so our brain is a cognitive miser. It doesn't want to think because thinking takes energy. It's easier to just be lazy. And certainly and sadly, you see that is so true nowadays in today's world where people just don't want to think. So where was I going with this? Well, fake news, fake work. Oh, yes, fake work. We're back on the subject of fake work. Now, this article said that it now takes, because the mathematical equation for mining Bitcoin is getting harder as the coins become scarcer. Okay, and you have this scarcity, so the math gets harder. I know this is a really abstract concept, but hey, so is fractional reserve banking and fractional reserve lending and the way the whole central banking cartel and the Federal Reserve work. That's a total abstraction too, and it took me many years to get my head around that concept, and I still don't know if I really understand it. I mean, I kind of think I do, but it's really a weird concept, and we've talked about that on 909 past episodes to one degree or another. So mining coins, mining cryptocurrencies, by having computers in buildings suck energy and do math to get you a coin out of not the ground, like a precious metal or a diamond, but to get it out of cyberspace. Yes. You tell these computers to run mathematical equations, which is the equivalent of having a tractor and mining equipment and, I don't know, what do they use to mine? What are those machines called? Well, those big giant earth movers and everything else they use, right? All of that equipment, you don't need to use it. You just have a computer do a bunch of math, really complex math, and coins are mined out of cyberspace. Well, guess what? Talking about fake work to produce something fake, okay? So you have, and I've said this before, and in a way I'd love nothing more than to be wrong about the concept of cryptocurrencies and what I believe is a tulip bubble that will crash horrendously at some point. But I'd love to be wrong about that because I would love to have an alternative to the fiat currencies created by government. Okay, fiat meaning by authority, right? The currency only has value because someone says so. But I don't think I'm going to be wrong. And here's why. Because now, this article, it said, it now takes the equivalent of 1 week of energy, what could power an average house for 1 week to mine one Bitcoin. So here we have essentially an idea, a fiat currency. Bitcoin is fiat currency, and so is every other cryptocurrency, okay? Now, it's not fiat in the sense that A standing army tells you it has value, and a government with a standing army behind it, it has value because it's a belief system, essentially. And there are certain people in the world, not many of them looking at the whole picture, but there are certain people who are really crazy about this, and it's like tulip mania, okay? It's a mania. You know, read Bill Bonner's book about manias, and there's so many books written about this. Great. It's a mania, okay? So you have a fake currency, and you have fake work creating tons of environmental damage, real environmental damage, to mine these coins. Now, I mean, it's not really producing anything. It's kind of like saying war stimulates the economy. War does not stimulate the economy. War destroys things. Yes, it gives a boost temporarily, but ultimately it destroys things. War is not good. Okay, war is not good for anybody except defense contractors temporarily, right? But it does not stimulate the economy. Anyway, I don't know if I've kind of totally made my point there. We'll talk about it more on upcoming episodes. But I just think it's a really interesting concept that so many people are so crazy about this stuff. And tomorrow, there can be a new cryptocurrency invented, and everybody will rush over to that one. I don't know. Again, I'd love to be wrong, but I don't think I'm going to be wrong about this. What is going to happen is there will be some sort of blockchain-style technology that is ultimately adopted by the powers that be, the central banking cartels, the governments. They will institute it with their currencies, and that will win the game. Because why? Well, I've told you before, they have standing armies, they have aircraft carriers, they have intercontinental ballistic missiles, they have all kinds of things at their disposal. They have the power of law, the power to inflict violence, you know, the power to control societies. They will win the day. That's who I would place my bet on, as sad as it is in many ways. Okay, so be sure you get your tickets for our upcoming Meet the Masters of Income Property event. We now have, go look at jasonhartman.com/masters, because we now have are three levels of tickets offered. Of course, we have Dr. Ron Paul, former congressman, America's foremost advocate for liberty, presidential candidate Ron Paul speaking at our event, Brian Smith, the founder of UGG Boots, Garrett Sutton, Rich Dad Advisor, his third year with us, Danielle DiMartino Booth, founder of Money Strong, columnist for Bloomberg View, and former advisor to the Federal Reserve, Andrew Zatlin, the Moneyball economist, John Burns, CEO of John Burns Real Estate Consulting. He's a forecasting expert. Really great. And then a new speaker announcement that I don't think we've mentioned yet, and that is Ken McElroy, another Robert Kiyosaki Rich Dad advisor. Ken McElroy has an amazing track record in property management and development, building apartment buildings, and I think has about 8,000 units in his portfolio now, if I'm not mistaken. Truly an amazing story. That's our main kind of celebrity speaker lineup. But of course, as always, at Meet the Masters of Income Property, we will have our local market specialists, property management teams, our mortgage people. We will have tax advice, legal advice. Well, Garrett Sutton will give the legal advice. And all kinds of great speakers at this event. Again, it's so jam-packed. We took it from 2 days to 3 days. So it'll be Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in mid-January. Start the year off right. Beautiful La Jolla, California. jasonhartman.com/masters. Get your tickets for that today. We now have two levels above general admission. We have a VIP level and an elite access level, which includes a dinner with Ron Paul. So you can get real intimate and, you know, really get up close and personal. And that includes green room access. So you can meet the speakers, have a photo op with them. And hey, who wouldn't want to get a photo with Dr. Ron Paul, Brian Smith, founder of UGG Boots, Garrett Sutton, Rich Dad Advisor, Danielle DiMartino Booth, Andrew Zatlin, John Burns, and Ken McElroy? You can get photos with all of them in the green room. It's going to be a great event. So join us for that. Don't miss it. We will also, if you've already purchased tickets, which about 150 of you have already, we will have an upgrade page coming out soon, so you have the opportunity to upgrade your ticket. Now, one more thing I want to mention. this would be a fantastic time for you to join the Venture Alliance Mastermind Group. Why? Because Venture Alliance members automatically, they get into all the events for free, and they have the top level of access. They have elite access to this event. So they get every VIP thing as well as the dinner honoring Ron Paul. Right now, those tickets are selling for $1,500. So if you join the Venture Alliance, that's just included. So, you know, it's kind of like getting a discount on the Venture Alliance. So it's a very good time to join the Venture Alliance. And for more on that, VentureAllianceMastermind.com. Okay, without further ado, let's get to Mark Sanborn. Let's talk about the Fred Factor, the potential principle, and a lot more. Here we go. Every 10th episode, we do something kind of special, kind of different. What we do is we go off topic. So regardless of which show it is on the Hartman Media Network, whether it be one of the financial shows, economics, real estate investing, travel, longevity, all of the other topics that we have, every 10th episode, we go off topic, and we explore something of general interest, something of general life success value. And so many of our listeners around the world in 164 countries have absolutely loved our 10th episode shows. So that's what we're going to do today. And let's go ahead and get to our guest with a special 10th episode show. And of course, on the next episode, we'll be back to our regular programming. Here we go. It's my pleasure to welcome Mark Sanborn to the show. He is the former president of NSA, the National Speakers Association, a fantastic organization. I was a member for about 10 years. He's a New York Times best-selling author of The Fred Factor. You've probably heard of that book. And Fred 2.0. And the new book, The Potential Principle. And many other books as well. Mark, welcome. How are you?
Jason, thank you. I'm great. Here in Denver, Colorado. Nice fall day, so it's great to be with you.
Yeah, Denver's a beautiful place. Well, it's great to have you on the show. You know, I have followed your work for years and certainly familiar with the Fred Factor, but your new book is exciting. Tell us more about the potential principle.
The potential principle is very simple. You know, we all know how good we've become, but none of us know how good we could be. Like you, I've had a chance to work with a lot of very successful people, and I've never had anyone be able to, or actually even try to prove that they have reached their maximum potential, that they're doing as good as they could possibly humanly do. And when most of us wake up in the morning, we kind of assume that our life is going to be better than it was the day before, you know, that we'll have more fun or better relationships or make more money. But the real interesting dilemma is that very few people consciously choose to do the things that will ensure that. So I wrote a book about how to keep getting better, regardless how good you already are.
That's great. You know, I remember, Mark, one of my original mentors when I was age 17 was Dennis Waitley and Earl Nightingale, Jim Rohn, and Zig Ziglar. They were like my four mentors as a teenager and pretty good mentors there. And Dennis Waitley used to talk about the concept of permanent potential. In other words, how people have all of this potential that they could reach and they just don't tap into it. And, you know, that's a sad thing, isn't it?
Oh, I think it is. And some people, at least they claim to be totally content with the way they are. You know, they don't have a conscious plan to accomplish more, to make their lives better. But most people that I meet and work with, they would love to be better. They just have an intention without a plan. Matter of fact, we did some research for the book and found that 57% of the people we interviewed all had a commitment to getting better, but only 30% had a specific plan. So there's a big disconnect between awareness and action.
Yeah, no question about it. When you talk about the potential principle, I mean, does that apply to like everything in life, or is it just our careers? Or I assume it's a broad concept, just more potential in achieving that potential in every area, right?
Well, that's a good question, because one of the things I address early on in the book is a very obvious but important question, and that is, better at what? Certainly, the book is written in such a way that you can apply it to a hobby or to your business or to your career, your relationships for that matter. But what I point out in the book is that you should really reserve your best efforts to get better at what matters most to you. And that is so important because, you know, depending where you're at in your life's journey, You might decide that you've become as good as you want in one area and that you want to lean your ladder up against a different wall of success and learn a new skill set or start a new business or build a new relationship. So I always ask people to get clear before they start trying to apply the matrix and the principles on what is it that you're trying to improve. The answer is whatever is most important to you.
Yeah, very good point. Very good point. So you have a matrix that you talk about in the potential principle. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the potential matrix identifies the four areas where any of us could get better. Interestingly, most of us spend most of our time in only one of the four areas. Those four areas are performing, learning, reflecting, and thinking. Certainly, thinking and reflecting are inner world activities, and performing and learning are outer world activities. Where we are most evaluated is obviously in our performance. You know, I can see what you're doing, I can hear what you're saying. But the problem is that if we don't develop the inner world as well, we often get to that place where we say, you know, why am I even doing this? Why have I spent so much time? Why have I blown up a marriage? Why have I sacrificed my health? And so what I suggest to people is, even though you probably have a preference, actually the quadrant that I prefer personally is thinking. I love to think, I love to read, formulate ideas. Even though we have a preferred quadrant, there's great benefit into improving in each of those four areas, becoming a better thinker, using learning to improve our performance, and then reflecting on what we do so that we get insights on how we can do it better.
Yeah, good. Okay, so becoming a better thinker. I mean, is the potential matrix something we use and fill out? Like, you talk about this daily plan. People will just sort of assume their life is going to get better, you know, and I mean, that's a good thing to have hope and think that the future is brighter than the past. The best is yet to come. But what do we do every day?
Well, I'll give you an example. First, the potential matrix simply focuses you on four areas you need to attend to. And it's not a perfect 25% balance in each of the four. If you really enjoy the world of performing, you might want to think about how to better prepare or how to gain a competitive advantage in your performance. Or you might want to learn a new skill that would allow you to improve your performance. So the matrix is just a really good visual reminder of the four areas you need to attend to over time. Then there are four techniques, and the first one is probably the easiest to understand, and even though it requires a certain amount of courage, it's one of the most important. And that is to disrupt yourself before somebody or something else does.
Yeah, that's talked a lot about in the business world of, you know, being willing to cannibalize your own business. That takes a lot of guts. Some examples are business will have one product line or, you know, something that's going very well. Well, why would you upset the apple cart, right? But you can bet that some competitor out there is going to upset it for you. And the gutsy thing, but hard to do thing, is to just disrupt it yourself, right? And then cannibalize your own business. Talk to us more about that as it applies to the potential principle.
Sure. Well, at an organizational level, there's lots of great examples. Think BlackBerry. Think Nokia.
Companies that didn't do it, right?
No, they were in at one time. They were high flyers. That's what's interesting.
Yeah.
I think the great danger is as you become successful, you keep doing what made you successful. And that's not a bad idea until what made you successful doesn't keep you successful.
Yeah.
You know, we all have a tendency to keep doing things beyond their shelf life. You know, we do something that makes us successful. It starts working not as well. So what do? We do more of it. You know, mm-hmm. We turn up the volume instead of asking, what do I need to do differently or stop doing or start doing? And so in the book, I talk about looking for the processes, the practices, and the relationships in your business or your life that need disrupted. And sometimes people get freaked out and say, well, I don't want to disrupt a relationship. Well, think about it. If you don't disrupt a complacent non-performer on your team, eventually what will happen? You'll have to let them go.
Right.
That to me is a far worse disruption than going to that person and saying, you know, I value you. Let's talk about what you need to do so that you can continue to be a contributing part of the team.
You know, is there a certain aspect of this that really applies to humility and not being cocky? I love the quote. I think it was Napoleon who said, "The most dangerous moment comes with victory." And when you mentioned BlackBerry, for example, and I thought you were going to say, well, these people didn't disrupt their business. And so I guess they did originally, but then later they didn't because, you know, the iPhone and Android just killed them later on. But we sort of get really confident when we succeed, and that can become a real problem after a while, right?
Indeed. I always say that, you know, what drives me is 50% pride in what I do and 50% gut-wrenching fear that if I don't keep doing it well and making it better, I won't get to do it anymore. And, you know, the Android and the iPhone disrupted Nokia. And that's really what the concept that I write about comes from. If you don't disrupt yourself, somebody or something else will, whether it's a competitor in the marketplace, whether it's another company, a new technology. And so leaders really are those people who are willing to say there's always got to be a better way. Let's not assume that just because we were successful last week, we'll be successful next week, next month, or next year. And so they're always looking for ways to get better.
Yeah, definitely constant and never-ending improvement. Very, very good philosophy. Okay, so what else do we need to know about the potential principle? I want to ask you just for a moment before you go about some of your other work, if you're willing to talk about that, the five friends, the Fred factor, of course, but let's talk about the potential principle a little more.
Sure. Well, another technique that's, again, very easy to understand and powerful to use is engage others. And what I mean by that is think who before you think how. I mean, how many times have we faced a problem that we tried to solve on by ourselves, we came up with a solution, didn't work very well, only to find out somebody else already knew how to solve the problem. But we looked for the how before we looked for the who. Whenever I have a need, whether it's a business need or a referral for a service, or I want to know, you know, what's the best book to read on a certain subject, I think, who do I know, who can I engage that can point me in the right direction? Sometimes that's, you know, a paid coach, or sometimes it's a seminar that you attend or a class that you take. Other times it's just people in your network. And, you know, you mentioned the five friends, so this might be a good time to say that, you know, that's a classic example of how five of us that were friends and enjoyed drinking bourbon and eating good food together, how we were able to go past that and turn it into a business enterprise or an undertaking where we could challenge each other's thinking. We put together some training. We blogged together, shot videos together. And that was a really powerful collaboration.
Yeah, and definitely, you know, that other person, that who that you mentioned, Mark, is someone who might have spent an entire career studying that. And I mean, the acceleration potential of just reaching out with maybe one phone call or one email to that person. You don't need to read that book. You don't need to learn that thing, right? You don't need to do the how. You can just do the who, and it can really accelerate your growth, right?
Exactly. It condenses the best thinking down into knowing who are the best thinkers. I spend as much time selecting books to read as I do reading books, because haven't we all gotten a book and got halfway through it and realized it really wasn't doing anything for us?
Right.
And so we wasted 100 pages of reading. Maybe if we'd have been a little more exhaustive in our research and determining what to read, then what we read would be, you know, more effective and pay off.
Mm-hmm. Give a tip or two on how you research what to read. I mean, do you just read the reviews, you know, online or what?
I do look at reviews, but what I look to is, again, using the idea of my network. I know the people who are on the same wavelength, who have similar success and aspirations in my business as I do. So I'll ask them. Matter of fact, it's funny. Just today, just for fun, on my personal Facebook page, I put up a post. I said, "What's the best book you've read lately?" And I've probably had 40 people in the last 6 hours weigh in. Mm-hmm. And so I'll go through their recommendations. And I've already looked at one, and the person recommended it highly. I looked at the reviews, and I don't care if the review is negative or positive. I care why it's negative or positive. Mm-hmm. Somebody says they don't like a book. That doesn't tell you anything. If they tell you why they don't like it or why they like it, there's where the insight is. Regrettably, a lot of reviews in any area, whether it's Yelp or Amazon,
they're fake. Yeah.
They're designed to be punitive. You know, it's
right.
Like that guy looks, that author looks like my ex-wife's new husband. So I hate his guts.
Yeah,
right.
Right. Right. Right. Or they're written by, you'll find the negative reviews a lot of times are written by a competitor, a competing book, a competing restaurant, whatever. And of course, the positive ones are written by all their friends.
Yeah, exactly.
I would say, right.
Discard the high end and the low end, and you'll probably come up with a more accurate.
Look to the middle. Yeah. Good advice. Good advice. Okay. So you're talking about spending time selecting what to read and looking for the who, not the how. I love that, by the way. Looking for the who, not the how. What else should we know?
Well, I would say that what precedes, and I don't write about this so much in the potential principle per se, but it's been an underlying theme in all of my books from the Fred Factor to today. The underlying theme is that nobody can prevent you from choosing to be extraordinary. We weren't all lucky enough to be born into families that encouraged us or rewarded us or taught us how to be extraordinary. And as a matter of fact, some of the greatest achievers I've met have been people who had the biggest obstacles to overcome. They became extraordinary, not because of, but in spite of. So I always like to remind people that, you know, if you don't want to be extraordinary, there's nothing wrong with that. That's your choice. You know, that's called free will. But if you really want to be extraordinary, don't let external circumstances like your current employer or your lack of appreciation by others, don't let that determine your course in life.
Absolutely. Great, great points. Great points. So the five friends, you know, I remember hearing Jim Rohn talk about that, about the, you know, your income will be the average of the five people you spend most of your time with. With your concept of the five friends, just dive into that a little bit more for us.
The important thing about any collegial group, whether you call it a mastermind or just your inner circle, is to me twofold. One is a clarity of purpose on how you can help each other. And number two are some basic shared values. That doesn't necessarily mean you're the same political persuasion. As a matter of fact, some of my closest friends are 180 degrees opposite me in my political views. But it's the heart, it's the values, it's the intellectual rigor that we share. And it's people that you can trust who love you enough to tell you the truth, because most people don't love you enough to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
They want you to like them, so they blow smoke. They spin it. They withhold information they don't think you'll like. But the five friends, Larry Winget, Joe Calloway, Scott McCain, Randy Pennington, and myself, we have an agreement that if one of us sees another of us doing something really stupid, to call us on it. You know, we have given each other literal permission to say, hey, BS, that's not right. Your thinking is askew. You're too full of yourself, or whatever the case may be. And that's really nice to have people, first, that have that permission, but secondly, who, when they tell you, you know that it's in your best interest to listen. You know, I always tell people, if you can't learn something from a critic, ignore them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's always a critic. It's the critic that loves you enough to give you advice you can use that you should pay attention to.
Very, very good thoughts there. Okay, let's talk about Fred for a moment, if we can. This is, I think, your magnum opus. Is that correct? I mean, you know, you look on Amazon and 371 reviews, 4.5 stars. The Fred Factor has got a huge following. I know that. This is your biggest book, right?
Indeed. It is my biggest book. It sold about 1 million copies in the U.S. and then another 1 million internationally.
Wow. That's extraordinary. And in an era when something like 120,000 business books are being published every year or some crazy number like that, that is extraordinary. I mean, you just hardly ever hear about numbers like that for book sales. First of all, just kind of as an author, what do you attribute the success of the Fred Factor to?
I've been asked that question a number of times, so I have a ready answer. I'm not being flip. But you know, the Fred Factor is about a postal carrier, a real-life postal carrier, who took this really ordinary job and made it artistry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason the book is successful is because it's not about Elon Musk or Bill Gates or Warren Buffett. Because when you read books like that, there's a little voice in your head that says, yeah, but those are three of the richest guys in the world, right?
Right.
Sure, they're successful. But when you take a guy that has what could be considered a pretty redundant dead-end job, and you show how he built relationships and created value and made such an impact, a positive impact in the lives of others, what that does is it kind of kicks the legs out from underneath any excuse you and I might have and say, well, you know, that may be true for what he does, but in my job, let me tell you, I don't have any opportunities. Sure you do. We all have opportunities to turn whatever we do, because we all have ordinary lives. That's what we all start with. We wake up in the morning. So extraordinary is a choice, and Fred Shea, the real-life postal carrier who is the focus of the book, is just a great example of that.
How did you know Fred Shea? I mean, was that your mailman?
Yeah, he delivered my mail. I met him back in 1988 when I bought my first house in Denver. He introduced himself on the front porch of my house and started giving me such great service. We became friends. I spoke about him in my work and then much later wrote the book about him. And he did retire about 3 years ago, but you know, he was a longtime employee of the Postal Service and just the kind of postal carrier or service provider anybody would want to have.
I am curious, did Fred's life change a lot after, you know, this book just took off like that?
It changed a good bit. I was really gratified. He said it was the most important thing outside of his family that's ever happened to him.
Wow.
What's really cool about Fred is, you know, he never did what he did in the hopes that somebody'd write a book or that, you know, he'd get a promotion. He's a real old-fashioned guy who just did it because, A, he believed it was the right thing to do. Wow, there's a crazy concept.
Yeah, right.
And B, he enjoyed doing it. I always tell people, you know, the way that Fred does business is a whole lot more fun. If you've got an eight-hour-a-day job and you can choose to be bored for 8 hours or you can find a way to make it interesting, it's to your advantage, you know, to make your life interesting instead of to make your life tedious.
Absolutely. I can't imagine the amount of goodwill that Fred has behind him. You know, of course, your goodwill, you made the guy famous, obviously, but, you know, just other people that just notice how he goes the extra mile. And, you know, I just love that. And it's interesting in my building here, I live in a high rise condo. The person at the security gate, I mean, one of them, obviously there's many, is one of them is just terrible. It's like she goes to work every day and she's the walking dead. I mean, seriously, it's ridiculous. But then you go inside and Carlos, the doorman, he's Fred. He loves what he does. He brightens everybody's day. He's incredible. I mean, he's just an incredible guy. You know, when Carlos is on duty, I never push the elevator button because I don't have to. He just calls the elevator down for me and you know, pushes my floor and it goes right there. I never have to take my hands out of my pockets. It's just such a stark difference. You know, it's I hope we all notice the Freds in our life because they're all there, aren't they? We just sometimes don't notice them, do we?
We don't notice them or we don't appreciate them. I'll say, if you want to have more Freds in your life, pay attention to the ones you've already got.
Yeah, good point.
If you're sincere, nobody is going to push back that you appreciate them. You know, you don't hear people complaining that they, well, you know, I hate about working here. People are so nice. They appreciate me. They thank me. They're grateful. I hate that. You just don't hear that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, amazing. I know we've got to wrap it up, but teach us something real quickly about Fred. Like, I mean, everything you said makes a lot of sense, and that's great. But, like, what can we learn from Fred just kind of quickly as we wrap it up?
First principle, and perhaps the most important one, is that everybody makes a difference, and the only question is what kind. You know, I'm trying to remind people that at some practical or maybe some theoretical level, being neutral is possible, but at a very practical level, when you don't engage others, when you aren't pleasant, you make a negative difference in their life. You know, just like I'm sure the security guard you reference outside your building, she probably thinks, hey, I don't like my job. I don't bother anybody. I'm minding my own business. And yet her whole demeanor is off-putting. And so I tell people, don't tell your kids and your coworkers they can make a difference. Tell them they do make a difference and that their decision is, am I going to build people up or am I going to diminish them? You know, am I going to move the ball down the field or am I going to take a loss? And that to me is the foundation, getting past this idea that you can move through life like some kind of phantom vapor.
Yeah, that's a great point. Of course, the movie many of us watch every year, It's a Wonderful Life, taught us how our life impacts everybody else's. And, you know, that next person you come in contact with, they might be considering suicide. They might, you know, who knows what they're going through and what tiny thing you could do that makes such a difference to someone else. You may never hear about it, but really can make a huge difference, huh?
I agree 100%.
Yeah, good stuff. Mark, where can people find out more about you and all of your great work?
Well, it's pretty easy. MarkSanborn.com, MarkSanborn.com. I blog. I have a video library. It's all accessible for free for people to learn new ideas on how to be extraordinary in their business and in their life. That also provides the various links to my social media where I basically share ideas pretty much 5 days out of every 7.
Good stuff. So you just came out with the new book that we talked about, but kind of curious, what's next for you?
Working on another book. I've got 2 book ideas. We're trying to decide, meaning my literary team and my publisher, what I'm going to write about. But I continue to give speeches and try to very hard to practice what I teach. And by the way, if your listeners want to specifically learn about the newest book, they can go to potentialprinciple.com. Potentialprinciple.com, that's a standalone website, and that'll give them even more information than we've talked about on the show today.
Fantastic. Well, Mark Sanborn, thank you so much for joining us today. Of course, The Fred Factor, The Potential Principle, and many other books on how to be extraordinary and how to be a great leader. Thanks again for what you do, and appreciate you coming on the show.
My pleasure. Great to be with you, Jason.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, HartmanMedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.